This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The Gemara says in the Chagiga Daf Hey Amud Bez, Rebbe, the famous Rebbe, had a Nakit Sefer Kinos. It was Tisha B'Av, and Rebbe took a Sefer Kinos in his hand, the Kokori Begave, and he was reading inside the Sefer Kinos. Ki Mato Lahai Pesuke Hashlech Mishamayim Eretz. As he got to the pasuk which refers to the fact that the Tiferes Israel, that the greatness of the Jewish people had been cast from the heavens down to the earth, Hishlich Mishamayim Eretz, Nofal Min Yodeh, the Sefer Kinos fell from his hands. He was holding the Sefer, and the Sefer fell onto the ground. Omar, he said, Me Igro Ram Lebiro Amikta, from such elevated heights to such deep down depths, to such depths of despair. That's what the Gemara says. Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz asks, what is the connection between the Sefer falling and the Pasuk he was reading and the statement he made? The Pasuk he's reading is Hishlich Mishamayim Eretz Tiferes Yisrael, that the Ribbono Shel Olam threw the glory of Israel from the heavens down onto the earth. That's the Pasuk he was reading. That was the verse he was reading. The action, the Sefer falls down. And says Rebbe, Oi, he says, Me Igro Ram, from such elevated heights, Labiro Amikta, to such depths. And Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz learns an incredible pshat in this Gemara. He says, what amazed Rebbe, what Rebbe realized as the Sefer fell, it was a mistake, the Sefer fell out of his hands just at that moment, and the watching the falling of the Sefer was a limud that gave Rebbe an understanding of the Pasuk and an understanding of life which he would not have had otherwise. You see how a Rebbe learns a Pasuk and how he sees the falling of a Sefer. We don't even when we've got a book in front of us, we don't learn it properly. And never mind when it's just something that happens in life, we don't learn it up properly. Even if it's just a stupid science fiction film or something, how we don't learn it up properly. How much more so when it's a book falls onto the floor. Rebbe gives a whole mitzvah Shabbos shir on the book falling from the floor. Here we just have the note. We have the one, the point, that's all we have. The interstitial, the last line we have of his shir. But you can imagine how he gave a whole shir on this, about the book that fell, the Sefer Kinos that fell from his hand. What did he see? Says Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz, he noticed the book was damaged, the book was broken. Why did it break? Because it was on the floor? No. Makes no difference where the book is. Because it fell. The damage is not from where the book is. The damage is from the fall. That's where all the damage occurred. And he understood what it means, Hishlich Mishamayim Eretz Tiferes Yisrael. That he threw it. Not just that it was on the ground. On Tisha B'Av we don't just mourn the fact that Tiferes Yisrael is down on the ground. That the Tiferes, that the status of the Jewish people is low. That's not what we're mourning. What we're mourning is the fall. These things happen. Nothing's a coincidence. What we're learning about is the fall. What we're mourning about on Tisha B'Av is the fall, is the mi igro ram, the Bira Amikta, this tremendous fall, the drop, and the damage which has been done by the fall. And he says the same applies with human beings. It's not where we are that's important. Everybody's on their own level. That's not what's important. One person is not better than somebody else because of where he is. Where he is can be due to all sorts of things which are even not his due, not his fault or not to his credit. People are born with advantages, people are born with disadvantages. What's important is not where you are. What's important is, are you rising or are you falling? And when a person is falling, the damage is from the fall, from the act of falling is the damage, not from where you happen to land up after having fallen. Therefore he talks about how careful one has to be when one finds oneself in a matzav of yerida, when one finds oneself in a state of deterioration, when one finds oneself falling, One finds oneself going down. How one has to arrest that. Because it's not just because we're worried about where you're going to land. We're worried about the damage which is occurring every moment of your falling, every day of your fall. More and more damage is being affected by the fall itself. Never mind where you're going to land up. That's not what's important. When a person has fallen, it's just something, unfortunately, that we all experience. Anybody who's occupied in the business of rising is occupied in the business of falling. There's no way that one can just consistently rise and rise and rise. Altogether, this whole business of rising and falling is interesting, and one time we must talk about it. When I was learning to fly, I eventually gave up learning to fly. So the reason I told my wife that I've given up learning to fly is I said, it's too expensive, we can't afford it, there are more important things to spend money on. The reason I told my flying instructor that I couldn't manage anymore was, no time, sorry, it's lovely but too busy. The real reason was because I couldn't take the spins that you have to do in order to get your license. And I couldn't understand it. I couldn't take spins. I wouldn't be able to take parachuting. I can't understand people who take skydiving. I don't understand what it is. And the emotion of coming down is, to me personally, in an aeroplane, a lot less comfortable than the emotion of rising, which I thoroughly enjoy. Takeoff, which is the most dangerous part of flying by far, is the period that I enjoy most of all. Whether I'm flying the plane or I'm a passenger in the plane, makes no difference. And landing, which really isn't dangerous at all, it's the easiest, it's the safest. They're most uncomfortable, don't like it at all. And I started doing a bit of research, are there any other Meshugoyim like me? And I found, to my great relief, that people involved in spiritual things genuinely don't like diving and falling. The emotion, the feeling of falling, even in its physical form, is the antithesis of everything you're trying to do. And people who are involved in very physical and sporty lives enjoy the feeling of falling much more than the feeling of soaring. It's a very strange thing, but ask people and you'll find the same. Ask people whether they enjoy the motion, the downward motion of a fast elevator, or the upward motion of a fast elevator. And you can virtually tell where the man is holding by what type of motion he finds less intolerable. As I say, it was a great relief to me in my discovery. But here too we see the concept of the damage being done by the act of Yerida. Stop the fall, not because we're worried about where you land. If you can fall miles, you can fall terribly far. If you're strong enough, you can pick yourself up from those depths and you can rise again. That's not the problem. The problem is you can get so damaged in the fall that you can't pick yourself up, even from a small fall. That's what we're worried about. And that's why when I see that a person hasn't come to a shiur once, a person hasn't come to a shiur twice, a person isn't coming to the davening, what is it that bothers me as an educator? That he's missed a shiur, that he won't be able to make it up? You can make up a shiur, that's not the problem. It takes you a little bit longer to understand that it can be made up. What is it that worries me? That the person didn't hear what I had to say or what somebody else had to say? That's not the problem. The problem is when a person usually comes to a shiur, and this is the proof of the pudding, a person who never comes to the shiur, I don't worry about. It's only if the person who normally comes in 2-3 weeks is not there, then I want to know what's going on. Surely I should be more worried about the one who never comes? No. The one who never comes is not falling. He's consistent. The one who normally comes and isn't coming is in a state of fall. He's depressed, he's miserable, he's busy, he's overworked. There can be many reasons for it. It doesn't matter. But he's in a state of deterioration. There's no way one can retain an elevated state without the pressure of having to learn. I don't just mean formal learning necessarily. Without the pressure of having to learn, without the pressure of having to perform. That's why I give shiurim. There's no way that you can occupy yourself in a normal life in Western society and improve yourself without massive pressure that is being applied to you every single day. And one day without the pressure and it's done. And again, you're not lower today than you were a week ago. Let's say a man who started coming to shiurim 5 years ago, and he comes come every day for 5 years, he's a Talmid Chacham already. He can learn a piece of Gemara nicely, he can learn a pshat in the Gemara. He's well developed. Now for 2 weeks he's not at a shiur. Is he worse than he was 5 years ago? Of course not. Is he worse than he was 1 year ago? Of course not. And yet he is. Because a year ago he didn't know very much, or 5 years ago he didn't know very much, but he was healthy. Now he's fallen. When a man has fallen, he hurts himself. When a man has hurt himself, he needs medical attention. He needs to be fixed, he needs to be repaired. He can't just pick himself up and go. It doesn't work like that. You can't jump out of an aeroplane and say, well, it doesn't matter, I'm back on the ground, start again. No. You're back on the ground, you're lucky if you're alive, and if you're alive, you're certainly going to spend some time in hospital before you're back again. And that's how it is. When a person is normally keeping something up and all of a sudden there's a fall, what we worry about is that the damage caused by the fall is such that it's going to be hard for him to pick himself up to where he needs to be and to where he would want to be. That's a concept that I've done with you before. I want to turn the concept around 180 degrees, and this we haven't done before. If it is possible for a person to be damaged by a fall, and we say again, we are not talking about where you land, that's not important. You can fall from the 105th story of the Empire. How tall is the Empire State Building? 105. You can fall from the 105th story of the Empire State Building to the 50th story, and you can't claim, but I'm still higher than the Carlton Center. You're damaged, you're finished. Doesn't matter where you are, you've fallen. And that's what has to be avoided at all times. Not to measure where you are, but where you've come from, where you've fallen. That's where the danger is measured, and that's where the damage is incurred. What would be if we try the other way around and we say, if the damage occurs through falling, irrespective of where you land, isn't there benefit to be gained through rising, irrespective of where you land up eventually? The same as we suffer the consequences of a fall, surely we can benefit from soaring, from elevation, just from the mere act of moving, even if it's from moving from 0 to 10. Perhaps I'm better off moving from 0 to 10 than I am staying stagnant at 100. Perhaps the emotions, the feelings, the elevation of moving upwards from 0 to 10 is enough to stimulate me and to spur me on further, whereas the man who's stagnant at 100 is there, and that's where he stays, he doesn't go any further. The answer is yes, absolutely, the thing works in converse too. That what's important is where you're moving. And the truth is that with human beings, unfortunately or fortunately, there is no such thing as stagnation. When you think you're stagnant, you're falling. When you're rising, you feel it, you know it. There's no way that one can say stagnant, because even if one is stagnant, one's one day further away from one's birth and one day closer to one's death. And that's not stagnant. That's deterioration. The only way that coming closer to the end of your life is not deterioration is if you're doing something with that day. If you have come not one day closer to your death, but one day closer to perfection, then you've achieved. But if all you've done is to remain stagnant today, retain my level, that's not stagnant. That's severe fall. That's severe deterioration. And one has to worry about what damage might have been inflicted as a result of that deterioration, of that fall. And on the contrary, when a human being is rising, irrespective of where he's holding in that rise, if the movement is one of upward, there's a tremendous amount to be gained. The Mishnah says in Psochim Daf Kuf Tes Zayin, I'm pleased to see that at least Pesach is as popular as E.T. That's a relief already. The Mishnah says in Psochim Daf Kuf Tes Zayin, it's quoted in the Haggadah, it's utilized in the Haggadah, Matchilin Matchil Bignayu Mesayim Bishvach, that it's important in relating the story of the Haggadah to start Bignay, to start with the disreputable parts of the story of the Haggadah. We're not ashamed of our background. Our background, we like to say that we're children of Avraham, but on Pesach night we remind ourselves that we're grandchildren of Terach. And who was Terach? An idol worshiper. What did he know? Nothing. That's where we come from. And Avraham himself, during his first 70 years of life, even while he was searching for God, there were times when he went to an academy for the training of idolatrous priests. Avraham Avinu himself was also an Oved Avodah Zarah. It was later in his life that the Ribbono Shel brought him close to Torah, and he introduced himself to Torah, and that the Am Yisrael was established. But our origins were nothing to be proud of. And it's necessary on Pesach night to start there. And we do it again. We move up from there through the heights achieved by Avraham, through the heights achieved by Yitzchak, through the heights achieved by Yaakov, and then down to Mitzrayim. And then again we build up, right up to the heights of Matan Torah, and down with the Eagle. And we build up again, coming into Eretz Yisrael, and down. So our history goes up and down, up and down. but it's important to be matchil b'gnayu mesayim b'shvach. We should start with the disreputable part of our history and develop the story onto the reputable part. Why? Because that's what we're interested in Pesach. We're not just interested in the fact that we finished off at the foot of Mount Sinai. And you can see how irrelevant that is, because a moment later we were dancing around the golden calf at that same Mount Sinai. So that's not what's important, where you are. You can be at the greatest heights one moment, and the very next moment you can be down at the bottom. There's no guarantee, just because you're high today, that that's where you're going to stay. What's important is, are you in an upward movement or are you in a downward movement? That's what's important. Are you gaining height or are you losing height? If you're gaining height, you don't have to worry. There's nothing to worry about. If you're losing height, you have to worry immediately, and something has to be done to rectify it, because you're damaging yourself by the mere loss of height. Not only the fear of hitting the ground, but the mere loss of height is already causing you damage. When a person jumps off a building, chas v'sholem, he's dead before he hits the ground. It's not the ground that kills you, it's the fall that kills you. And immediately you've got to correct yourself long before the damage is done. And on Pesach, when we go through the Haggadah, the principle of Matchil B'Gnai and Mesayim B'Shvach, says the Maharal, is exactly this principle. The principle of understanding the movement from humble origins to greatness. It's the climb that we're watching, not just where we happen to be. It's the development that we're watching, not where we happen to be holding. That's why it is so difficult to measure in any kind of quantitative form one's progress in Torah, because you can't measure it in terms of where you are. It's not important where you are, how many mitzvahs you're keeping, how many daf of Gemara you've learned. All that is not important. There's only one thing which is important: am I rising or am I falling? Am I improving myself or am I deteriorating? Am I getting older or more mature? What am I doing? That's the only thing that's important, and that's not always that easy to define in a measurable way. But there's a medrash that goes even further than that. There's a pasuk in Micha chapter Zion that says, "Al tismechi oyevasili." Don't take joy in me, my enemy, oh my enemy. Don't take pleasure in me, oh my enemy. Ki nor falti. In that I have fallen. Because kamti. After my fall, I've gotten up. Don't laugh at me because I was on the ground. Don't take pleasure because I was down and out. Because don't forget, since that time, kamti. I've gotten up again. And that's what's important. Ki eshev b'choshech. When I sit in the dark and you want to take pleasure in that, Hashem Or Li, the Ribbono Shel Olam is my light. There is nothing at all for you to laugh at. I'm not in the dark. The Ribbono Shel Olam is my life. Says the Medrash Shulchan Aruch on Tehillim Kaf Beis, Il Malei Nofalti Lo Kamti. If it weren't that I fell, I could never have got up. Il Malei Yoshavti B'Choshech Lo Hayoyin Li. If it weren't that I was sitting in the dark, I would never have found the light. That's a very strange medrash. So what does that mean? Go into the dark so that you'll find the light. We should all fall every now and then. We should trip so that we can have the pleasure of getting up. Is that what it means? It doesn't mean that, but it almost means that. What it does mean is there can be no kimo. This feeling of getting up cannot be achieved if there hasn't been a fall. The feeling of experiencing light cannot be achieved if you don't come from darkness, if you haven't had the darkness before. And this is an amazing concept. Not only is the important thing the rate of elevation, that not only is that what's important, but without having experienced the fall and without being first in the depths, there cannot be the elevation for which one craves. And that one is better off having fallen and climbed out of that fall than one is just to remain static all the time on one level. Why? How can that be? That's an amazing thing. Does one have to lower one's level deliberately so that one can rise later on? Again, there is an amazing Maharal. And the Maharal learns in the beginning of Shmos, it says, "Vayomus Yosef v'chol echo v'chol hador hahu," and Yosef and all his brothers and all that generation died. "Uvenei Yisrael poru v'yishrutzu v'yirbu v'yatzmu b'moed moed," and the Bnei Yisrael multiplied and became tremendous in number, that in Malay Haaretz Oysom, and the land was became full of them. asked the Maharal, why does it seem that we had to wait until Yosef and his generation died before the Bnei Yisrael started multiplying? What's the one got to do with the other? If it was important that there would be a large number of Jews, why didn't they start multiplying from before already? Why did they remain a small family until that whole generation had died, and then they started multiplying? Says the Maharal, in a Kabbalistic sort of fashion which we won't get into, before they were a nation, the 70 souls that came down to Egypt was a complete unit. And he has a whole system on the number 70, which one day we might do, but not at the moment. But the number 70, as far as the group, the family of Yaakov was concerned, was completion. As far as the nation was concerned, it had to get to 600,000. Once it got to 600,000, it was also complete. And he goes into most magnificent mathematics in showing the uniqueness of the numbers 70 and the number 600,000, and why 70 is so specific to the family unit and 600,000 to the national unit. But his yesod is, the principle he comes out with is, that as long as the family unit was still there, as long as the 70 individuals who constituted that perfection were there in Egypt, there was no innate drive to further heights, because there was a degree of perfection. One needs to understand this. That when a nation, a unit, a family, an institution, a business, an individual reaches a point where it is complete, it loses its drive for further development. And it in fact has to be destroyed before that can develop any further. Only after there were no longer those 70 people, any of them, as long as there was one of those 70 people, there was sufficient perfection to deprive the people of a drive to further perfection. Once those people were left aside, were put aside, now the only time that Bnei Yisrael would reach perfection again is when there would be 600,000 of them. And now comes the drive to reach the numbers of 600,000. It sounds a very philosophic and concept, uncomplicated concept, but every gardener knows it. A tree grows and grows and grows, or a rose bush grows and grows, comes a point when it stops growing and it starts deteriorating, and you need to cut it back. You need to create adverse effects for it. You've got to create a situation where it has to battle to live. You have to create a situation where it's no longer fat and complacent. And the moment it loses its fatness and its complacency, it starts getting the energy that it needs to grow with much more strength and with much more vigor into something much stronger and much more beautiful. And that's part of the, if one wants to call it, the tragedy or the reality of life, that so often it's necessary to prune, to cut down, before things start operating properly again. One has to do it with one's own life, one has to do it with oneself sometimes. Sometimes one starts getting involved in too much, and one goes and on and on and on, and there's all of a sudden this feeling of stagnancy. One's not getting anywhere. What do you mean you're not getting anywhere? You're doing so much. What do you mean you're not getting anywhere? Comes the point you're doing so much that you're satisfied with what you're doing, and it's true you might be up there, but that feeling of rising, that feeling of soaring is gone. Not improving, not going places at all. And one needs to start cutting down. One needs to start chopping. One needs to start saying, no, sorry, I can't do this, I don't have time for this. One needs to cut down, until one's putting all one's energies into fewer things, and one can again build it up with the energy that one needs to feel that accomplishment of soaring, of getting on top of things, of moving upwards again. And one can't allow a thing just to grow and grow and grow and grow, and never cut it down, and expect it to have the vigor of growth, and the vigor which one requires in something of growth. So this is the Maharal, the same with Bnei Yisrael. As long as there were members of those 70 people around, they were so strong, they were so powerful, they were so strong in a moral sense and in a physical sense and in every sense, and they were born by this generation, but the drive to become a nation wasn't there. When those 70 people were gone, Yosef, v'chol echo, v'chol hadoirahu, Yosef, his brothers, and that whole generation was gone. Now there was only one thing left. They were no longer a family. They were too big to be a family, and they were too small to be a nation. There was this drive to become a nation immediately. And this drive expressed itself not only in the consciousness of the nation, but even in the subconsciousness of the nation, and even in the biology of the nation. That they started multiplying at a rate that was phenomenal in order to reach as quickly as possible to that level of perfection. And so it is with the Agoda. Matchilin Bignai is not only because we want to stress the movement, one wants to stress the rise from Gnai, from our humble origins to the heights we achieved later. But we want to show that we could never have achieved those heights if it weren't that our grandfather was Terach. That's the Chiddush of Matchilim B'Gnai. That's part of the Haggadah. That's part of the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's part of the story of Matan Torah. Without those humble, miserable beginnings, we would never have achieved it. And that's something that everybody needs to know. We need to know it to retain our own modesty. And we need to know it for the future. We need to know it to have our past in its correct perspective. And we need to know it for our future too. Don't think that now we've made it and now we can sit back. Now we're okay. Never. The moment you can sit back, you know you're in danger. The moment you feel you can start taking things easy, you know that you're in danger. You're in danger of falling. Imagine again, back to the same image. The airplane that reaches its altitude, and the pilot says, well, right, now we're on top, we can turn off the engines. It doesn't work like that. You need tremendous energy just to stay on the top, and you can never turn off your engines. Reb Yitzchak Kuttner takes this concept one step further than we've taken it. And he says that a question is to the mind what adversity is to the body or to the soul. What does he mean? Exactly as there is the danger in one's physical life that complacency leads to stagnancy, and that danger appears also in one's spiritual and national life, that complacency leads to stagnancy, and that it is only through the cutting back, that it is only through the struggle that one is actually able to reach the heights. In exactly the same way, intellectually we have the same concept. If you know something and you're satisfied with that piece of knowledge, you will never go any further with it. It's dead, stagnant. It is the kasha, it is the question which demonstrates the torment of the adversity in knowledge. The fact that I know something, but what I know I have difficulty with, it bothers me, I can't sleep at night. Why? Because that piece of information is incomplete. Like the Jewish people were incomplete after the 70 people died, after that generation died. It's incompletion, it's not full, it's not perfect yet. And the same as the soul craves for perfection, and the human being craves for elevation, so the mind craves for completion and for perfection. And a kasha, a question, is a demonstration, an expression of the gap between what is and what should be. And just as there's nothing more painful to the soul than the experience of the gap between potential and actual, if we knew our potentials, we wouldn't sleep at night. If we knew our potentials, we wouldn't eat. We would get sick. We would get ill from worry, from frustration, from torment. If we really saw how far we are from our potential, we wouldn't be able to live with ourselves. It's a chesed of the Ribbono Shel Olam that he keeps our greatness hidden from us. And that even people in their greatest moments of arrogance don't fully realize how great they are. It's a tragedy of human life, and it's also a chesed. It's also a kindness of human life. Because if we realized how great we were, how great we could be, we just wouldn't be able to look ourselves straight in the face. And a kasha, a question, is the expression of that very fact. That while I have the knowledge, while I know something in a certain sense, it doesn't give me the satisfaction of the completion of that knowledge and of the fulfillment of that knowledge. And therefore says Reb Yitzchak Kuttner that the same as the content of the Haggadah is dictated by the principle of Matchilin B'Gnai U'Mesayimin B'Shvach, that we start off with our miserable beginnings and build up to the Shvach and build up to our great heights eventually. Because what we're interested in showing is firstly the move from the bottom to the top, the actual rise, and secondly we're interested in showing that without those humble origins there couldn't have been the development to the great heights. So the style of the Haggadah, not only its content but also its style, has to be one which moves from lack to fulfillment. We talked at the Shabbos Haggadah Shir a little earlier that there are certain peculiar aspects about how one has to fulfill this mitzvah of Sikur Yetzias Mitzrayim. A lot of the Achronim ask the question why it is, what's special about this mitzvah? There's a mitzvah to mention Yetzias Mitzrayim. There's a mitzvah to mention the going out of Egypt every single day of one's life, once in the morning and once in the evening. So what's special about Pesach night? We've done it in Shul already, we mentioned Yetzias Mitzrayim. What's special about Pesach night? Why do we have to mention the same thing again on Pesach night? And what is unique about this mitzvah? And in the Shabbos HaGodol Shul, we pointed out the concept of Sipur. But it's not a mitzvah to tell it. And I said that there are two forms of acquiring knowledge, two forms of learning, two forms of teaching. I gave the example of Yisro. Yisro comes and joins the Jewish people. It says, Vayishma Yisro. Yisro heard and he came and joined them. Rashi asks, Chazal asks, what did he hear that drove a man to such insanity? Go and join the Jewish people. And at what time? They're embarking on a journey to who knows where, through a desert, for who knows how long. What they're going to eat? Nobody knows. What are they going to drink? Nobody knows. Where are they going? To some promised land somewhere that isn't even theirs, that other people living there. At that time, you, Yisrael, want to join them? What got into you? What did you hear that turned you on so much? Says Rashi, he heard about Kriyas Yamsuf, the splitting of the Red Sea, and he heard about the war of Amalek. Figured that if the Ribbono Shel Olam can do those things for them, he can do whatever else needs to be done, and he's ready to follow. 8 verses further, it says, Vayesaper Moshe LeYisro Chosle, and Moshe told Yitro, his father-in-law. And Rashi says, what did he tell him? He told him about Kriyas Yamsuf and about Amalek. And he asked, but that's what he's heard already. That he's the specialist in that. He appreciated those two elements so much that it actually brought him to come to Yiddishkeit. And now what are you teaching him? Why aren't you teaching him something new, Moshe? He's coming, he's all excited. He heard about Kriyas Yamsuf, he heard about Amalek, and he's coming to learn more. So go into the next sugya with him already. Start learning something new. Teach him about Shabbos, teach him about Kashrus, teach him about all sorts of beautiful things. Why go over the same thing? Says Rashi, Limshoich es libo. It was to attract him, to get him emotionally involved. You see, there are two kinds of limudim, there are two aspects of learning that both excite a human being. The one is learning something new. You learn something new, you feel growth. And that's a very measurable growth. Yesterday I didn't know it, today I did know it, so I have progressed. The truth is, it's not progress at all. Your knowledge has progressed. It means you know something today that you didn't know yesterday, but it doesn't mean you're a better person than you were yesterday. It is incorrect to say, I have progressed because I learned something today that I didn't have yesterday. I have progressed because I got a BA now and I didn't have a BA 3 years ago. Or I've got a PhD this year and I didn't have a PhD before, therefore I have progressed. I haven't progressed. Who says I've progressed? I have acquired something which I didn't have before. It's like saying I have progressed because I have a motor car today which I didn't have yesterday. It's nothing to do. The one has got nothing to do with the other. Progress is not dependent on the accumulation of assets. And whether the accumulation of assets are intellectual assets, or spiritual assets, or physical assets, it makes no difference. That is not a measure of progress. A measure of progress is when there's hamshochas halev, when the heart has been drawn into it too. And the concept of lesaper, we said, of telling the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, was not just to impart the information. It's true, we know the information already. There's a mitzvah every single day of our lives to remember the information, so the information is new to nobody. Yet we sit down with all that excitement on Pesach night to read over the same Haggadah we read last year, and the same Haggadah we read the year before, and on the second night Pesach, the same Haggadah we read last night. And we start again as if we've never seen it before, with the same excitement, and we talk about it as if it's all new. What is it? That's Chazorah. That's how one revises a thing with increased depth and with increased understanding. That's where one puts it into a seder, where one puts it into an order. It's not just facts, but it's facts made into a story. It has a beginning, it has a body, it has an end, a conclusion. It builds up. Matchilin b'gnai u'mesayimim b'shvach. It's the story of the rise of a people from absolute non-existent beginnings to the heights of Matan Torah. That's the story that we read, and it's a story on Pesach night. But what's the essence of Sipur? What is the essence of telling it in a way that it attracts people? Of telling it in a way that it changes people? Not only that it gives them more information, because after all, that's what we're talking about. We're saying to give them information, that's not what we're talking about. That's the mitzvah of Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim. Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, actually telling the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, that's Limshoich es halev, that's to make them involved, to involve them emotionally. How do you do it? What's different? answer. It has to be b'derech she'elah. It's got to be an answer to questions. And that is a requirement of the Seder night, as we learn. That even when there's nobody else present, even when you're on your own, well, let's start before that. If there's a child there, the child asks. If there's not a child there, the wife asks. And if the wife can't ask, the husband asks himself. And even two Talmidei Chachamim sitting together ask one another the questions. It is a requirement of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. The Chachamim require that it is done by way of answer to questions, even if they're your own questions. And even if the questions have been formulated by Chazal. Manish Tana is not a spontaneous question of a child. It's a question he has been taught to ask. But that sets the Haggadah off. And without the Manish Tana, you can't start the Haggadah. There has to be the question. And we do so many things on Pesach night to get those questions asked. And to get more questions asked as well. Those are the minimal questions that have to be asked. The dipping in the beginning of the Seder is to get questions asked. Handing out nuts to the children, which they used to do, is to get questions asked. And according to one of the views we learned in the Shabbos HaGodol Shir, the whole eating of the matzah, part of its aspect, is to get people involved in asking questions. Sipur, when one's involved in telling the story, we're not talking about telling a story to children. How do we tell the story to the Chacham? We learn halachas with him. We learn laws with him. Ein masir nachar Pesach afikoman. And we hope that at our table there are Chachomim, not just children. The story that we're talking about is not just the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. We're talking about making the halachas, making the laws into a story. That's done exactly the same way as the story is done. Let's look at it on two levels. Let's look at the child at the table. How do we make it a story for him? We've got to give a theme to it. It's got to be a beginning, there's got to be a moral, there's got to be a theme, there's got to be a conclusion. The Mishnah tells us the theme is Mesayim Matchilim Bignayu Mesayim Bishvach. It's a heroic story. The story of a struggle of a nation from humble beginnings to Matan Torah, to becoming in a relatively short time, in a very short time, to becoming a nation worthy of Matan Torah, to becoming God's chosen people. That's the story one tells me. When one's not dealing with a child, when one's dealing with a Talmid Chacham, how do you create the same effect? How do you turn Haggadah into Sipur? How do you turn the imparting of facts into the imparting of something emotional, of something that inspires? The answer is when you answer the question. And two Talmidei Chachomim are talking with one another, they don't want to hear a vort from one another. If you hear one man say to another, tell me a vort, you know he's not a Talmid Chacham. What I need you to tell me a vort for, I can tell my own vort. Don't need to hear a vort. If you hear two Talmidei Chachomim next to each other, you will inevitably, just listen, when you see two of them sitting next to each other, go and put your ear near them. The one will ask the other one a question. Not to try him out, not to test him. Oh, it's nice to see you here. I've been battling on the following idea. What do you think? What do you have to say on it? Puts a question to him. And then the conversation goes. Then it becomes emotional. Then it becomes involved. Then it's the answering of a question. Why is that? Because there's got to be that feeling of the gap which the information fills. Information which doesn't fill a gap is not exciting information. It's merely the collection of another asset. So yesterday I didn't have it, today I've got it, I can put it in my pocket and I can walk off, but it doesn't change me. It only changes me if I missed it yesterday and today I've got it. Then I'm different. I was imperfect yesterday and today I've got it. I couldn't understand something yesterday. I couldn't perceive and conceive of the world correctly yesterday because I was missing something. And what you've given me has answered what I had difficult. Then it feels good. Then I have changed. Then my whole outlook has changed. But if I had no questions yesterday and you just tell me a new piece of information today, not only doesn't it change me, that information becomes a burden. Where do you store it? How do you remember it? How do you keep it? What do you do with it? How do you utilize it? Just to bombard the human being with more information and with more information and more information. One of the consequences of the computer age, one of the consequences of the television age, we're bombarded with information at a rate that it's impossible to assimilate. And what does assimilation of information mean? To assimilate it to the point where you have caches on it, where you have questions. When you have a question and you wait a moment and you wait for the answer, then it's good. Then you understand. Then you feel it's part of you. Then it's integrated. Then you can move on to the next thing. But to have information coming at you so quickly that you don't have a chance to ask a question, that you don't have a chance to feel the lack before the next thing is given to you, that's like spoiling a child. It's exactly the same thing. Give a child a bicycle before he's missed the need for a bicycle, before he's noticed the need for the bicycle. Give a child a trip overseas before he knows what it is, what overseas is, and before he's craved and felt the absence of an overseas trip. It's spoiling. You're depriving the child of the ability to integrate the event. Can't be done that way. You have to create in the child the need, the craving, and then you fill that craving, then it's done properly, then it's correct. And we have to do that the same even in our own learning. When you're learning something, you need to ask questions. If you haven't got a question on what you've just learned, you're not ready to go into the next thing yet. That means you haven't integrated, and it means the next thing you're going to learn is just going to be a further accumulation of what you didn't have yesterday, so now you've got a little bit more. But there's no way that it's the fulfillment of a gap. And just as the same as without gnai, without starting at the bottom, you're not going to push yourself to the top, so without asking the question, you're never going to perceive the depths of the meaning. When Newton asked about the apple falling, why does the apple fall? Why doesn't it fly up? Was that a kasha or was it an answer? Was that a question or an answer? It was a question. But without that question, the answer would never have been found. Well, sit complacently under the tree and watch the apples falling. You're never going to discover gravity that way. It needs somebody to notice and to ask why. A balabatishu question, an ordinary stupid question. Why does it fall down? Why doesn't it fly up? That question needs to be formulated, it needs to be perceived, and it needs to be asked. And until it's been asked, it doesn't help telling Newton something else. He's not ready to assimilate anything else. He's not ready to understand anything else. That has to be at least questioned before you're going to give him further information. We find this in everything, by the way. And in fact, part of the purpose of these shiurim is just that. To get people to question. Not just to question what they learn, but also to question what they see. In fact, after last week's shiur, there were some interesting responses. Only some of which I'm aware. The two particular responses that I would need to mention here. The one was the response of, incredible, that I didn't notice it. One kind of response. How could I have not seen anything of it? Another response was, I did see it. I did notice it. But I rejected it as nonsensical. And a feeling of tsar, a feeling of pain. How could it be? And another emotion is all part of the same emotion. That's what the world has come to. That's what the world is. What can I do to make sure at least that I'm not affected by it? What can I do in my own way at least to start rectifying things? And then there was another emotion. Yeah, it's all very nice theoretically, but practically we live in the world as it is, and we've got to make do, and that's how it operates, and that's just tough luck. In this world it's forgive and forget, except when it's many or personalities, then it's not forgive and forget. It's true, it's opposite to the Torah, but that's how it is. We've just got to make peace with reality. That's contrary to the whole essence of noting a problem. To become complacent with the problem. What is that? What kind of sickness is that? We're talking up till now about a man who doesn't notice a problem. Good, okay. That's bad enough. But the man has had the problem pointed out to him. And says, okay, let's carry on as normal. He's able to completely divert the problem out of his mind and carry on as if it doesn't exist. What is that? That's that same intellectual complacency, that same spiritual complacency. The inability to see the seriousness of it and to see that we're in Bira Amikta, that we're deep down. At least if one sees that we're deep down, there's a chance that through that you're going to reach the heights that we're talking about. One can reach the Igra Rama, one can reach up to the top. If we haven't even noticed that you're down at the bottom, what chance is there of reaching the top? You think, this is a good place to be? It's like the Chaza wallowing in the mud. Happy as the day is long. He doesn't know there's anywhere else to be. That's the essence of Chazeres. That's the essence of being a Chaza. Wallowing in the mud and feeling comfortable. Wallowing in the mud, it can happen to anybody. You trip, you fall in the mud, it's terrible. But feel uncomfortable. To wallow in the mud and the tumor and the distorted views and the misunderstandings and the misrepresentations and say, but that's how it is, let's carry on. That deprives one of any possibility of getting out of the mud and getting onto some superior level. And that's why the Haggadah has to start with the Manishtanot, has to start with the questions. And that's why before we even really get involved in answering the questions, the Haggadah defines for us four sons. And the Maharal says these four contain within them all the types of people that there are. These are the four types of questions that are asked, that's all. What are they? Let's start at the end. There's the She'ina Yodea Lishol. The person who it's usually translated doesn't know how to ask a question. I want to translate it in the light of the Shia slightly differently. She'ina Yodea Lishol. He doesn't know anything that he can ask. To ask a question, you need to have knowledge. Then you analyze the knowledge. But if you don't have the knowledge, what are you going to ask? So remember, he doesn't have the information. He doesn't have the sforim. He doesn't know how to use the sforim. He doesn't know how to start learning a piece of Chumash or Gemara or Mishnah and to realize that there's a problem. Because he can't even start the learning process. So at Petachlo, we've got to start him off. And that is the meaning of the Higada Tol Levincho. You've got to give him the information. If that's the level you're operating on, where he's not even ready for questions, then he will become excited at new information. A man who has access to Sforim, a man who goes to Shiurim, he's not going to become excited by telling him something new. That's not going to excite him. He'll find he's doing that all the time, he's finding new things. That's level number one. That's the sine qua non. But what he gets excited at is a new understanding, a deeper. Excited about the questions that he's asked and about the answers that need to be given. That's what excites him. Shen Delishal, you've got to give him information. Tam. The Tam does ask a question. Ma Zos. What does that mean? Zos, whenever the Torah or Chazal use the word Ze or Zos, it means to something that to which you can point, something physically present. Whenever the word Zos is used. So when he says Ma'azos, he's pointing at the Seder table, he's pointing at the Matzah, he's pointing at the Moror, he's pointing at the Leaning, at the physical things that we do. So he's not an intellectual. He can't ask a question on a concept. But if he sees something which doesn't make sense, it bothers him. So he's a student, he's a Talmud Chochem in a sort of a sense, he asks, he notices, but not in a conceptual sense, not in an intellectual abstract sense. He only asks physically what he sees. This is Ma'azos, so we have to tell him in physical terms. You know, you can't get involved in philosophy. Tell him the story. We were slaves. It was terrible to be slaves. And the Rebbeinu Shlom took us out. And you're telling me the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. But that's to a Tam. That's not what you do to a Chacham. What do you do to a Chacham? He asks halachas. Moha idus v'achukim v'amishpotim. He's asking in the Sforim already. He's not working. He's not asking what's that, what's this. The Matzah is the physical manifestation of a set of halachas, a set of law. The whole Pesach Seder is a physical manifestation of a few sugyas of Gemara, pieces of Gemara. That's what it is. So the Tam sees the physical manifestation and he asks. The Chacham doesn't need that. He asks even without it. He asks in the Beis HaMedrash. He asks 30 days before Pesach. He's already asking these questions. He's asking on the concept. He's not only asking on the physical thing which he's seen. He's able to perceive inconsistency in his mind. He doesn't have to actually see it in front of him in a physical form. It's like the individual who is studying physics and asks kashas. That's one kind. You have the other individual who, when you take him to a nuclear reactor, he says, and what's that, and what's that, and how does that work? He asks good questions, intelligent questions. But he can only ask them when he sees the nuclear reactor working. And he sees big machinery and says, what is that for? And if that's for that, then what is that? He asks intelligent questions, but in the reactor, not in the laboratory. The Talmud Chochem, you can explain the concepts to him without the reactor. And he'll ask the same good kashas on the concepts, on the working of the concepts. That's the Talmud Chochem. With him we answer halachas. Teach him halachas. Teach him the laws. All his questions are going to be solved by understanding the halachas. He's not on the level where he wants to know the story. He wants to know why you're eating matzah. He wants to know the meaning of the dinin, the meaning of the halachas, their relationship one to the other, where they come from, how they operate. That's what you have to teach him. But he's asked the kashas, give him the answers. Then comes the Rosho. Before we deal with the Rosho, and really in conclusion, I just want to ask on the Ma'aral, because there's a sign missing. We've got the Chochem. The Chochem has information and asks questions on the information. That's good. He realizes he has the knowledge and he lacks the understanding. The question, the kasha, is the expression of possession of knowledge and lack of understanding. And that's like the matchinin bishbignai. That's like the humble beginnings. What I've got, I don't understand. It needs to be improved. It needs to be perfected. And we have the Tam, who doesn't have the knowledge. So we have to give him the knowledge. So those are the two levels which are easy to understand. But he knows how to formulate a question if you give him physical objects. You have the Shehinah Deir Lishol, who doesn't have the knowledge at all. What about the man who has the knowledge but doesn't know how to ask? The way we've explained She'enu Yodeh Lishol is not that he doesn't know how to ask, but that he does She'enu Yodeh Lishol. He knows nothing that he may ask. He doesn't have the information, so you've got to give him the information. The Tam, he has the information, but not in an intellectual way. The Rosha is the Rosha, the famous Rosha. The Chacham has the information in an intellectual way and asks the Kashas. What about the man who has all the information? He knows it all. Encyclopedia Britannica from the beginning to the end. You can ask him in it and he knows it. And he's got PhDs in every subject and knows the whole of Shas on top of it. But doesn't know how to ask the Kasha. His questions are not intelligent questions. Believe it or not, in the academic world, that's something one finds frighteningly often. A man full of academic information, and when he writes an article and presents a paper, you'll hear from the Mevinim, from the people who understand that area of academic involvement, that his questions are, he doesn't understand what it's all about. What about such a man? Why is he not included? And I think we have to say that he's the Rosha. I think we have to say that the man who has the knowledge and doesn't know how to ask a question, let's look at him for a moment. What does he do with the knowledge? Why does he want the knowledge? Why does he have the knowledge? What can he do with the knowledge? The Chacham is the man who is frustrated and tormented by his lack of understanding. And he deepens and deepens and deepens. And he takes that same knowledge and he works on it and works on it. And he'll sit the whole night on one word trying to figure out what it means. And at the end he'll get it, he'll understand it. And that will then open up for him a new aspect, a new dimension of looking at everything that he knows. And then he'll just beginning to relax and he'll look at something else. Oy, what a kashi, he has a tremendous problem. Can't sleep at night again. And he works and works and works. And eventually that problem is solved. The kashi is answered and he's at peace again for a few minutes until the next one comes. That's the Talmid Chacham. That's the man who's constantly occupied in the state of rising. Never stagnant. Always finding the lack, finding the chisorin, finding that which is missing in order to strive to the heights of accomplishment. That's the Chacham. What about the man who also has the knowledge but doesn't ask the kashas, doesn't know how to formulate a question, doesn't know how to notice an inconsistency and work on it until he's able to solve the inconsistency? So what's he going to do with his knowledge? Increase his understanding? He can't. I think here we have the difference between limud lishmo and limud shelo lishmo. Learning Torah for its own sake and learning Torah not for its own sake. Learning Torah for its own sake means exactly this. I'm learning in order to know, that's all. Why do you want to know? Because I want to know the Ratzon Hashem. I want to know what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants. I want to know what the Ribbono Shel Olam holds. I want to know what the Ribbono Shel Olam's views are. And I need to understand it. Every word of it needs to be understood. I would rather not know than misunderstand. It's more dangerous for me not to know incorrectly than not to know at all. And what I know, I need to know with full understanding. That's the Chacham. And you have the other person, the Shiloh Lishmo. He's learning, but not Lishmo. Why are you learning? So there are two kinds of the Gemara defines. The one is the Kovod. He's learning because he wants to a PhD behind his name. He's learning because he wants to be a rabbi. He's learning for whatever. He's learning as a form of acquiring Kovod. And on that the Gemara says, look, let him learn that way. Eventually he'll come, it'll stick with him. Eventually he'll raise his level. So we're not worried about that kind of man. He's just in a temporary transient point where he's going through the stage of learning for the wrong reasons. But then you've got another man. The man who's learning al manas lekanta. The man who uses his knowledge in order to feel superior. He feels that if he knows something that somebody else doesn't know, he is superior to them. And he's learning in order to feel superior. On that says the Gemara, Noyach lo shelo nivra. He would be better off never having been created. He's a dangerous human being. It's worse off, he would be better off never being created. The Rosha is the man who has the knowledge. He's not a man without knowledge. He knows the questions to ask. But he's a cynic. He's a man who is using his knowledge to attempt to expose the inadequacy of others. Ma avoida azis lachem. What are you people doing around over here? And I know all about it. I don't think you can teach me anything. I know what Pesach's all about. I know what the Seder's all about. I've been to Yeshiva. What are you doing it all for? That's the Rosh. The man who has outgrown his knowledge. And look at the danger. We learn when we're children in school, we learn Bible stories. We learn Chumash, we learn about Avraham, we learn about Yitzchak, we learn about Yaakov, we learn about the Ribbono Shel Olam, we learn about God and about Moshe and about Paroi. And it is taught to us in a way that as 6 and 7 year olds we can understand it. What then happens? We grow and we develop. We go through school, we go through high school, and now we're learning Shakespeare, now we're learning nuclear physics, and now we're learning advanced mathematics. And then we go to university, and we become specialists in various different areas. And then we go on to postgraduate work, and we're maturing, and we're deepening. Now we turn our minds to Moshe, to Ribbono Shel Olam, to Avram, to Yitzchak, to Yaakov, to Shabbos, to Kashrus. What are we looking at? We're using minds of 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, maturity of 50-year-olds, to look at a concept of a 6-year-old. What must you do? It's nonsensical. Laugh at it. Of course it's nonsense. Must be nonsense. That's a man who's outgrown his knowledge. A man who's acquired knowledge at a certain stage of his life and hasn't made the knowledge grow with him. The way of making the knowledge grow with you is the questioning. Always question, because as you grow, so your questions grow. The material stays the same. It's the same masechta that you learned today. It's the same masechta that you learned when you were a kid in cheder. Learning Gemara Psochim now, when you were a 12-year-old kid in Cheder, you were learning Gemara Psochim. It's the same Gemara, the same Rashi, the same Tosfos. It's exactly the same Gemara that the Vilna Gaon was learning so many hundreds of years ago. It's exactly the same Gemara that all the Gedolei Yisrael have been learning. No different, not one word different. And if you don't go over it again, as an adult, but with new questions and with new perceptions, as an adult you remain with your understanding in Gemara Psochim of a child, whether the child is 7 or 12 or 20 or 30 or 40, it makes no difference. If we're busy improving ourselves, we're talking of Aliyah, we're talking of moving forward. If we're busy moving forward as human beings, but not taking our knowledge with us, of course we outgrow our knowledge. And what do we become? Roshoim. That's what a Rosh is. A Rosh is not a man who doesn't know. A man who doesn't know is a Tinuk Shalish, but he doesn't know. That's not who we're talking about. The Rosh is the man who knows, but he's outgrown his knowledge. What are these silly things you're doing on Pesach night? He's a man of intelligence and of intellect, a man of depth, who has not perceived, who has not allowed his knowledge to grow together with him. That's the danger. And so we come out with an amazing and a frightening concept in a way. Just to summarize, we started off by saying that the damage of falling is in the fall, not in where you are. Where you land might be higher than where you were a week ago, but you're lower than where you were a week ago. You're in more danger than you were a week ago, because you've just suffered a fall and you're damaged. Contrary wise, when you're moving upwards, it makes a difference where you're holding. If you're in an upward move, you're gaining momentum and you have strength and you have dynamicism and you have siyata dishmaya, and there's forward movement. We said that that concept goes even further. Matchilin b'sknayim b'saimim b'shvach is A, to show that we're occupied in the story of the rise, not in where they landed up. They didn't land all that fantastically, but it's the story of the rise that we're busy with in the Haggadah. And more than that, that without the gnai in the beginning, without the ridiculously low levels from which we started, we could never have reached the heights. And that an individual has to know sometimes when he's going through depression, when he's going through low periods, when he's going through the darkness, he's got to know that that can be the beginning of the most exciting growth that can still come, provided he recognizes the darkness. If he sits in the dark and he thinks that's how it's meant to be, he's doomed to failure. But if he sits in the dark and he's tormented and aggravated and depressed with that darkness, he must know that he's on the beginning of an incredible rise, if he can utilize it for that. And then we came with the concept of switching that into the intellectual area. The man who has ideas and doesn't ask questions on those ideas is the man who isn't growing. And we're not interested where you're holding, we're not interested in how much you know. We're interested in the depth of your questions. Because the depth of your questions is the definition of the gap between what you know and what you understand. You can't ask a question if you don't know. That's the She'ena Yedei Elisha. You can't understand if you've never felt the gap between knowledge and understanding. One needs the knowledge, and one needs to be able to formulate the questions and be disturbed by the questions. That's the Tam and the Chacham, each one on his own level. The She'ena Yedei Elisha is lacking knowledge, we've got to give him knowledge. The Rosha is the man who's outgrown his knowledge. Rosha is the man who knows but hasn't kept up the questioning process. who's satisfied with the questions he asked in Cheder, and he's never asked any questions since, he's never opened it again and gone into it with a fresh mind. He's the man who hasn't defined the tremendous gap between his knowledge and his understanding. He's prepared to say that his understanding of a 6 year old was a satisfactory understanding, and therefore he rejects it. That's the Rosha, and that's what we have to avoid at all costs. And so of course the Maharal is 100% correct. These four combine all the four possibilities of people who are involved in learning and people involved in the collection of knowledge. The Sheini Adalishul who doesn't know, the Tam who knows in an unintellectual way, the Rosha who knows without asking, and the Chochem who knows and who asks. Mitzvah Hashem, with that, you should take your approach to the Seder. Don't prepare the Haggadah, don't prepare your Seder. Open your Haggadah at the Seder and learn it. Sit around the table and have a learning session. Have a sip. That's all. Ask, answer. Even if you don't have the answers. Even if your whole Seder is only a list of Ma'anishtanas, that's all you manage to do, is to ask a question on every line. That's also wonderful. Because you're tormenting yourself. You're experiencing that gnai, you're experiencing that feeling of incompetence, that not knowing, of not understanding. And that feeling is the very feeling of gnai which pushes one to the shvach. That's the very feeling of incompetence that drives one to the heights of achievement to which we'll ultimately reach.